Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to our final episode of Lions Watch, your one-stop shop for all things England. I'm Marcus Speller.
And I'm Luke Moore.
We're just over a week away from England's Euros opener, but there are still many unanswered questions. Today, we discuss who should replace Trent Alexander-Arnold and how England must adapt without two of their mainstays. We also reflect on some of the lessons from England's last international break.
Well, that was the worst performance I've ever seen from an England team, ever. We were totally hopeless for 90 minutes.
It's another wretched night for England at a major tournament.
Did you also miss a left-footed player down the left side?
Yeah, but where is that player?
How are we going to win this tournament as England?
And England win on penalties!
It's the last episode, Luke Moore.
It is.
For this series of Lions Watch, because then we sort of merge with mainstream football ramble.
Mainstream ramble.
Yeah, exactly, into the tournament.
Absolutely right.
Because we've convinced them all that international football is the way forward. We've chucked the club season out the way.
Mission accomplished.
Which is what we're all about.
I said to you, Marcus, if we get this right, I think we can stop the domestic season. And we have done. We have done.
We have. And my goodness, what a triumph it's been. So we turn our attention immediately to Trent Alexander-Arnold. All the chat about four right backs, which we got right, didn't we?
We did.
We knew he was going to do it. And just as well he did, because we're now down to three.
Yes.
Or so we think, because we don't know who's going to replace it, but it's unlikely.
I don't think he's going to pick a replacement.
that would be good if he did.
I would be here for it, but I don't think it's going to happen. And in your intro, when you said there are still many unanswered questions, would you say there are too many still? Or do you think every nation's in this position, more or less?
Well, I don't have my ear to the ground as much with the other nations.
I don't even know how else is qualified.
Exactly, yeah. I mean,
no point.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't. It's all immaterial, of course. Yeah. So I think, well, let's discuss that then. So first and foremost, Trent Alexander-Arnold ruled out of the Euros, of course, with an injury, which is so unlucky.
It is.
Like, just to think of that on his level, that's so unfortunate. Right at the end of a pre-tournament friendly, it happens. And for those who are thinking, would he start, would he play his part? You know, I even said he could be an impact sub, which, let's be honest, how many other countries would have a right back as an impact kind of sub? That's all gone now. He's out of the picture. And the players that Southgate have as standbys, which I don't think was made that clear to the press. People were like, well, why are these players still knocking around?
Yeah.
Southgate himself said, you know, let's learn even from the Trevor Sinclair example when he flew back from Japan and he turned around at the airport and flew all the way back. So there are a handful of replacements there. Lingard, Ward-Prowse, Godfrey, White and Watkins. Immediately, who do you think will go in for Alexander-Arnold?
Well, I think that it's not likely to be Godfrey or White, personally, and I think it's also unlikely to be Watkins. The reason I don't think it's going to be Godfrey or White is because Southgate has already said that they're there long for the experience, essentially a glorified version of training with the England squad, which I think is, you know, reasonable, and I'm sure he's been absolutely transparent with them about that. And I also think it's because realistically they're not going to feature. Then what you are doing there, and I mean this with the greatest respect to those players, you're almost not quite wasting a place, but you're given yourself a luxury of a player who realistically isn't going to feature, right? We know he loves Lingard. We know he loves James Ward-Prowse.
We all love Lingard.
Well, yeah, we're fine, absolutely. But we're not picking the team.
And we all love Ward-Prowse, don't we, Lee?
Well, kind of. But the point is he's used these players.
Yeah.
As soon as Jesse Lingard's form improved, he picked him and he played him. James Ward-Prowse, he's played a lot, even though Southampton have had a poor season. Ollie Watkins is a bit more of an interesting one. You wouldn't have thought that he's different enough from the strikers they've got, the out-and-out strikers, to think of a situation where you're necessarily going to use him unless it's going to be a last roll of the dice, let's get him on there. He's clearly not as favoured as Dominic Calvert-Lewin. Now, I'm not attributing a judgment to that. I'm saying that's how Southgate sees it. So for me, it feels like people have already commented that central midfield looks perhaps a little bit light given the injury issues. Because let's not forget, Rice has also had match fitness problems, and obviously Henderson. And Lingard, just because he likes him, just because also, with the exception of possibly Mason Mount, and I'll defer to your superior knowledge on this one, Marcus, I don't think there's that many players that are like Lingard. And Southgate also pointedly said in the most recent press conference, Lingard's great for the group. So for me, it looks like it's going to be the Lingard or Ward-Prowse. That would be my prediction, but I don't have any particular inside knowledge about that. In fact, I even texted a couple of journalists this week, and neither of them did either. Yeah. Either that, they just didn't want to give me their knowledge, which is fair enough. Absolutely fair enough.
Yeah, I agree.
Hope you're listening, Ollie Kay. Hope you're doing well.
I agree with you with Watkins or Ward-Prowse. I think that Lingard or Ward-Prowse. I think that much more likely. I mean, he knows what he gets with Lingard, and I think with Lingard as well, you have to pick a player that is also good for the group. You have 26 players. It's a challenge with 23. I know sometimes it's hard to squish it down to 23, and it's still been quite difficult with 26. But you have to, Gary Lewin spoke about this last week, you have to keep everybody engaged and everyone has their role to play.
Yeah.
And Lingard is a player he probably doesn't worry about. Lingard will strike up the band when they need to. Lingard has tournament experience with England. Admittedly, he played, so there could be a challenge with Lingard thinking, well, hang on, I've played a lot of minutes in Russia. You know. But if he does take Lingard, of course, but that would be
I don't think players do think like that anyway. I don't think Jesse Lingard's thinking, I was great 3 years ago, so I should be here. I think you think that. But I don't think the players themselves...
Where's Dele Alli? That's what I want to know.
I don't think the players themselves think like that because they're so used to having to prove their ability so often, and he's had such a difficult time of it, both personally and professionally. And what we're seeing here is a renaissance in his career. And I think if he had gone, it's easy to say in hindsight, but if he had gone to West Ham at the start of the season and done this all season, would he be starting games for England? Possibly.
Yeah. Well, he started the one against Austria. which raised a few eyebrows.
And the thing that put him on the radar in this studio, of course, is that famous, how could we forget, assist against San Marino.
Yeah.
You know, and we'll come on to that later, of course, I'm sure.
Of course we will, in England's evolution.
Yeah.
What did you make of the Austria game, though? It was interesting to see Declan Rice and Jude Bellingham were kind of more in front of the back four, with Jack Grealish given a bit of a kind of a number 10 freer role.
Yeah.
Harry Kane sort of standing on his toes a little bit, if you see what I mean. Much was made of that. But people want to see Grealish. He's a very, very exciting player. There's no doubt about that. But England, in those kind of wide attacking places, which Grealish we've seen him play a lot, have a fair few options there. England do look a little bit soft at the core, but with regards to wide options, they seem to be okay. What did you make of Grealish's performance? And do you think that he should be featuring for England quite a lot?
I think his performance was excellent. I think he's great because of all the things you've said there, but also something that we've alluded to this week and actually earlier in the season as well, when we were calling out for him to be called up by England, you know, probably quite a bit earlier than he actually was. Mm-hmm. I don't think we were alone in that. I think a lot of the media was. Is that he's so hard to defend against. Mm. That people, I haven't seen this mentioned enough. It's very, very difficult to defend against a player like Grealish, not because of his ability. His ability is a big part of it. He's got a tremendous amount of ability. But you don't really know what he's going to do. Mm. If you watch a game, we've watched thousands of games over the years. Doesn't make us experts or whatever, but we have been enthusiasts for football for a long time. You watch a lot of players.
Nobody can slag off our enthusiasm.
No one can slag off the minutes I've put in watching games. Most of them shit. But it's very difficult to see how Grealish does what he does and what he's going to do next. Mm. He does really just pop up everywhere. And the reason this is even more impactful, I believe, is because in the world of football in 2021, it's quite a regimented, shape-orientated sport. Mm. And Grealish kind of upturns that. So he clearly can go and do, not necessarily what he wants, because you can't really do that at this level, I don't think, but he can go in there and he can do things like draw a foul for you. And he'll draw fouls everywhere. Mm. Like, he'll pop up there, he'll swap over, and he presents a really difficult problem for the other team to solve. And I like that about England, because I think England spend a lot of their time worrying about other teams. Mm-hmm. Because the pressure's so high. So to answer your question more broadly, I would say the Austria game, there was a lot of positives. Mm. They looked very good for large portions of the game. I think that Jude Bellingham was a really great plus. I don't think he's found his ceiling yet, and I think Southgate can trust him to go and do a job in there if we need him to. And I think we should forget about his age. He's full of beans. He's full of energy. He's got a good discipline. Mm. He did it. It was a passage of play, Marcus. I'm sure you remember it, where he picked up the ball, pushed it out wide, did the right thing. And the cross came in, or it might have even been a corner after that play. And he popped up, arrived late with a massive header, but it went straight to the keeper. Mm. And he looked like a man grown. It was like a Lampard-esque powerful header. Obviously, the direction wasn't quite right, but it was like, and it made me think at that point, bloody hell, yeah, he can do everything.
Yeah.
So he's full of energy. I do think that they became a bit ragged. Now, I understand that that's probably because of the changes that were preordained and that, you know, it's a friendly and all the rest of it. But I didn't like what I saw in portions of the game.
Rostra should have equalised.
They should have. And I think they've got some good players and they're obviously qualified for the tournament. And England are going to come up against teams who aren't necessarily fancied. And they're going to play against players who perhaps Sabitzer, Alaba, they're good players. Mm. They're playing in average teams necessarily, but they're good players.
You mentioned Jude Bellingham a fair few times there, understandably so. Now, in our starting 11 that we tweeted out recently, we had Jordan Henderson, starting 11 for the Croatia game.
Yeah.
We had him in there. Jonathan Wilson agreed with us, so up yours, everybody.
Yeah.
But plenty of people had their opinions, I'm sure. And since then, I've even started second-guessing what we put out there.
I did when it went out.
Yeah. And it's a difficult one to choose. There are some obvious ones, but it's again, it's usually sort of the wide players. But one position... It's Jordan Henderson. If you think, it shows you what he means to Southgate and perhaps the group, that he hasn't played any kind of real football since February.
Yeah.
It's a long time.
I think February the 20th, yeah.
Yeah. And there's still obvious question marks over his fitness. I mean, Southgate is really, really desperately trying to pull out all the stops so he can get Henderson in there. If he's not in there, surely Jude Bellingham's the one that just slots straight in there. In fact, I'm more of the opinion now with what Southgate's saying about Henderson being a doubt for Croatia, is that actually Bellingham could and perhaps should start that game. It's a demanding game. And I just, with Henderson, I know Gary Lewin last week spoke about Henderson in, you know, you're trying to, you know, go all the way to the final. So he's got a number of games to get fit and all that kind of stuff, and you do have the extra three players in the squad, I just wonder that, is Henderson going to even make the squad at this rate? You know, Southgate's obviously got another sort of week or whatever it is, the cut-off date for injuries and so on. But the point I'm sort of labouring to make here is that Jude Bellingham could actually start all, you know, quite a lot of games for England in this tournament. And when I say a lot of games, we've obviously got three definites. We hope that England get at least four, yeah, and hopefully more. But do you see that then, Luke, as actually a position where you're less worried about England?
Yeah, because I think if you take the points in order, talking about our team that we put out there on social media, I would be happy if we had to replace Henderson with Bellingham, and I'd be happy if we had to replace Walker with James, for example. The point of this is that you have to pick 11, right? And also the wider point of this, and you know, if we've been totally honest, and lots of other media outlets won't be honest, we wanted the engagement on social media, so we put it out there. We thought it'd be an interesting thing for people to talk about. I think that the same points I've made about Grealish, you could argue that Bellingham does for England in a slightly different way. Gives the other team a problem to solve. They're going to look at Bellingham, even modern football, Croatia, and they're going to go, okay, we can watch him, we can watch tape of him, but he's a young player. We don't know that much about him. No one in our camp really knows him, you know. Put him on 35-year-old Modric. Why not? Yeah. I mean, Croatia are going to rely on some ageing players. Mm-hmm. If you look at the game they played against Slovenia, in the World Cup qualifier, they lost 1-0. They played Modric, Brozovic and Kovacic. Mm-hmm. Brozovic and Kovacic are a little bit younger, obviously. Mm-hmm. Kovacic is a top player and has won lots of things, as we've talked about. Brozovic is also great, but he's also quite one-dimensional. Mm-hmm. Look, put Bellingham in the midfield. Mm-hmm. Give him something to think about. What, let them worry about when Grealish is going to pop up next and when Bellingham's engine's ever going to run out of fuel, when it's not in the first game of a tournament. I'm very happy with that. It presents you with a different approach, because if you get Henderson in there and you assume Henderson is match fit, he's a cool, calm head with a lot of experience and can orchestrate and can almost quarterback the midfield. That's fine. But there's more than one way to skin a cat, right? If you put Bellingham in there, it gives them a different challenge to deal with. And I think I'll be perfectly happy with that. I've got no issue with it. I do think, realistically, the writing is probably on the wall now. And the best case scenario for Henderson is that you're going to get him for an hour, maybe, against Croatia. And then you have to decide whether you want to do that or not.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can't see any difference to that, can you?
Really? Well, no, you can't. I mean, that's and this is the thing. You know, if they're looking at it thinking, well, he might not even be available for any of the group games, you know, I mean, do you then take him?
Well, there's a wider point, Marcus, as well, which is that England's best chance of being successful at this tournament is by attacking, because at the back, they're not as good.
No.
And they weren't as good before Maguire got injured. Mm. And they're definitely not as good now.
Yeah.
So you have to give the other team something to think about. Otherwise, you're going to limp through the tournament and just hope that no one punishes you, which is no way to do it, because the best teams are going to punish you. You cannot go... If we get drawn again, I don't quite know how the draw will work. As we said before, it's difficult to work it out because of the 24-team thing. Mm-hmm. England play Portugal in a semi-final, and they line up with...
What could be a second-round game, actually.
Well, okay, then. Yeah. And they line up with Cristiano Ronaldo, João Felix and Diogo Jota, right? What are you going to do? Hope they don't score? You can't.
That's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Well, I hope they don't score, but that's not a plan, is
well,
it?
Well, you're right. And so you mentioned Maguire there. I'm actually much more worried about Maguire's fitness than Henderson's. And I know Maguire's had his critics, but that shows you what England are like. As I said, you know, at the core of this side, it's a little bit soft. Rio Ferdinand has criticised Gareth Southgate for taking Maguire, saying it could be a distraction. And people are now looking at Maguire, I think, and they're sort of pondering, going, bloody Nora, well, okay, if Maguire's not there, who then do you bring in?
That's the point. And I think we have to assume, I suppose, that Ferdinand has some knowledge of Maguire with his contacts, but I also think he's being informed perhaps by some of his own experiences. And then we have to go back to what Gary Lewin said last week with you and Vish, where he said every injury is different, right? Mm-hmm. So it depends what we're talking about with Maguire. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about Maguire doing like a Steven Gerrard, where he just has to have an injection in his ankle and he can get through the tournament, and he wants to do that, and the club sign off on it or whatever, it's not a problem, is it? But if we're talking about proper stretched ligaments, which is 3, 4, 5 weeks out, depending on the severity of it, then it could be a distraction. Mm. If Rio Ferdinand knows that, he should tell everyone.
Well, Ferdinand knows what it's like to try and forge a centre-back partnership with someone.
Well, he also knows what it's like to get injured in the first training session of a tournament.
He does. And so Stones and Maguire are the preferred choice, or the first choice, for a lot of people. That partnership doesn't fill you with huge confidence, but, you know, you'd think, okay, fine, we'll settle with that. But if Maguire's not there, there are doubts over Mings' capability. Cody, again, not had a brilliant season with Wolves, but you'd say he's probably the more likely. But if Maguire then doesn't make it, you're calling up what was probably Ben Godfrey from the reserve list. So again, it does sort of start to thin out, and you'd be forgiven for thinking, poor old Michael Keane, where's he in all this? You know, but you can't get bogged down with that because he's not involved at all. So the question is, and we'll talk about this as well with England's evolution, is against Romania, do you go back three or back four? Because if Maguire doesn't make it, will Southgate be tempted to put an extra defender in there?
I think he will.
Reshape the whole formation?
I think it was Jim who said it last week or this week or whatever, that it's much more likely that he'll go to a back three/five without Maguire. And I understand that. And I think there's some benefits to that. I think you then lose
an attacking player.
You do, but I said it depends, though. It depends because it's so fluid now. If you play 3-5-2, you don't necessarily, because it depends.
Okay.
It's a little bit more nuanced, isn't
it? But basically, I think England fans, as you mentioned, want to attack. They want to see Mason Mount in an attacking midfield role. They want to see Kane up top with Foden or Grealish or Sancho, that kind of thing. You play a back three, you lose one of them. You probably have Bellingham and Rice in the centre, and then Mount, Kane, Foden maybe. You don't have Grealish, you don't have... Do you see what I mean? You lose one of those players. And that is the dilemma for Southgate with the back three.
And what I was going to... It's fair. It's
and that will disappoint fans, but this is the tension in between. How far do you want to go? Or do you want to play the swashbuckling?
Well, the fans are going to be disappointed. They need to be disappointed with Maguire's ankle injury, not with Gareth Southgate's decisions, because he has to play the best team he can. And I think if all things being equal, you've got a clean bill of health going into this tournament. And I'd be very surprised if any nation has got that, given the season we've just had. All things being equal, you want to play a 4-3-3, right? Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't see any argument to not wanting to play a 4-3-3. I don't like... we talked about this, I think, or you and Vish talked about it with the Belgium games, where they play 3-4-3. I didn't really like it. Mm. But if they have to do it, there are benefits to it. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get bogged down with tactical chat all day, because I'm not a tactical expert at all anyway, and people will get bored. But the point is that there are some benefits to playing three at the back. Cody's more comfortable there. You get more protection for Stones. Mm-hmm. You can play Walker there, who then in certain situations you can become a four, because Walker's so versatile and you change the shape slightly depending if you're in possession or not. So I think we get too bogged down with it. I think we've talked about it a bit in a different context about the way that players are labelled. Mm-hmm. The way Germany label their players when they pick a national squad is kind of slightly different. Mm-hmm. Germany list Kai Havertz and Joshua Kimmich as midfield players. As I said to you before, Kai Havertz played up front for Chelsea in the Champions League final, and he's nowhere near the same player as Joshua Kimmich.
But you've got to play them somewhere.
Fine, absolutely. But you've got to react to the hand you've been dealt. Mm-hmm. And do you want to see, like in the dark old days, a half-fit injected David Beckham wandering around with a foot injury, or Wayne Rooney's metatarsal? Or do you want to say, tough shit, the next best player is this player, the next best formation is this formation, let's do it. Because every single team, every single nation coming into this is going to have a problem. And even if they don't, they might have one after 5 minutes of the first game. England needs to be able to deal with this. They need to be able to deal with the fact that in the first game, in the first 5 minutes, Harry Kane might break his ankle. I don't want him to, no one does, but he could. So we need to be able to get in this mindset of not worrying about what's happened in the past and adapt. And if we do that, we've got a far better chance. But we still won't probably win.
Croatia reaches the World Cup final for the very first time, and after all that effort, all that energy, the ghost of 66 lives on for England.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
and receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Bernie Katz was fun, he was kind. When he walked in, the room just lit up.
And there was something magical about this young man that just had a glint in his eye, that didn't give a shit about anything, but loved everything.
My first impressions were of a huge, vibrant and outgoing personality, all hugs, grins, extravagant language and wild attire.
Always in a leopard skin jacket, whirling around like a windmill. I know, she's a character. I don't know if those people exist anymore. They're sort of dying out. Everything's changed.
It is a bank holiday weekend in London, the late summer of 2017. The streets around Kentish Town, just north of the city and halfway towards Hampstead Heath, are unusually quiet. That evening, in a small, converted flat, just a 15-minute bus ride from King's Cross Station, Bernie Katz, pocket-sized and long-standing front-of-house manager of London's Groucho Club, is found dead by his landlord.
I said to him, what happened? You know, and he said, we are not talking about it. And yes, there have been the rumours. We've all heard. I mean, what did I hear specifically? That he was murdered.
His relationship with his father was so toxic. He hated the idea that his son was gay. His dad was a proper gangster. Bernie came down, there was a car far from. Guy blows his dad's head off.
They're all part of the same fetid, seething, self-referential nest of vipers that I think the Groucho have become.
Was Bernie depressive? I think yes. When alone, a condition he rarely sought, he had demons that flew about his head.
I get a call from Bernie and he is in £20,000 worth of debt with the Albanian gangsters in Soho. We all collected and paid the debt.
The way that the Albanians operate is very, very peculiar because they did not operate like any other mafia in Europe.
I've never been able to establish exactly what happened and why, but whatever it was so wrong.
Bernie, who killed the Prince of Soho? Listen now. A Stack production, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Right, everybody, it's time for England's evolution. I mean, we're right up to the present day.
Yeah.
Really. I mean, each week we've been looking back at the eras and the major tournaments that have shaped this England side since World Cup 2010.
It's certainly been faster than Darwin's evolution. I mean, it's taken us merely 9 weeks.
Indeed. And we've packed in just as much. this week, we're in March 2021 for England's most recent international break with the World Cup qualification, of course, for the 2022 World Cup. Seems crazy to think about that, but we're there. So, yes, of course, after the damp squib of the UEFA Nations League qualifying and England playing a 3-4-3 against Belgium, we talked about that, the World Cup qualifiers rolled into town and England beat San Marino 5-0 at home, of course. Then the second game was away to Albania. And this is where we kind of really pick it up. England were playing a 4-3-3. And after that 3-4-3 experiment, which you mentioned previously, Luke, Southgate, I think, seemed to think, right, okay, let's go for a more attacking approach here. Look at the players we've got. This is let's play to our strengths, really. And that's what we began to see. You had Stones and Maguire at the back, Shaw and Walker with the fullbacks, Mason Mount and Phil Foden started, and they just seem like obvious choices now.
Yeah,
very, very quickly. They've not got many caps, especially Phil Foden. It's just kind of, well, of course he's starting for England.
Yeah,
you know, he's like a duck to water. They were in there. There were concerns about Kane's position dropping too deep in the game against Albania. He did score though. Mason Mount scored the second, and Mason Mount it was now looking like a player who could easily go on to get 50 plus caps, and that may even be a conservative estimate as
well.
Yeah,
I think it probably is.
So the win against Albania was your typical, you're going against a stubborn side who you're expected to beat, but they had no mugs. They were at the Euros in 2016. You go there, do a job, win 2-0, and off you go with the 3 points. And it's exactly what England did with very few scares. The home game against Poland, of course, the England won 2-1. That was a sterner test. Poland are the best group, the best team that England will face in that group. Southgate again went for a 4-3-3. Rice, Phillips and Mount in the midfield. Phil Foden started once more. And I think this game is, because of the friendlies against, you know, Austria and then, of course, Romania that are coming, we know that there's a lot of players. The Chelsea, Man City boys are not going to play. I don't think they're going to play even against Romania. Mm. Man United players weren't featuring against Austria even in, as well. Pre-tournament friendly, you know, again, players who were on the standby list were playing. This game against Poland is perhaps maybe a little insight into what Southgate's thinking for the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, you'll no doubt be unsurprised to know, Marcus, that I refused on a point of principle to not watch back the San Marino game.
Scumbag.
But I do register for the record Jesse Lingard's assist. Mm-hmm. And that can't, no one can take that away from him. Mm. And, you know, hopefully, you know, maybe we'll see him, given what's happened, maybe we'll see him this summer again. I found it interesting watching the games back because I found it interesting how quickly these new players are coming through all the time. And I think this is becoming a hallmark of Southgate's tenure. Mm. And when we look back on it after he departs the job, which he will at some point, Marcus.
At some point,
he's got to deal with it. That's how it goes.
Yeah. And we'll, he's got a long queue of people lining up to take
it. Yeah, obviously. For sure, yeah. Yeah. Big Sam, for example. we will look back on this tenure of Southgate and say, my goodness me, how quickly he brought these club players through.
Yeah.
It's all very well that England are now producing these players and producing these different types of players. But the manager's got to be willing to take a chance on him, on them. And it's not that long ago that you would have players who were playing really well for their clubs that couldn't get a look in, because it would always be Lampard and Gerrard in the midfield, or it would always be, you know, whoever playing up front. Mm. It would always be John Terry at the back. And I'm not saying they weren't worthy of it, but I mean, it's hard to think of something that's more bulletproof than John Terry's England position, right, for a large amount of time.
I mean, you know...
That's not really the case here, is it?
No, it's not the case. I mean, that did show the quality of the player, though.
Of course.
But I think with this group of players, Southgate has made playing for England a very attractive thing for a lot of young players again. And I think
100%.
And I think that people are like, I want to be a part of that. That looks like a bloody good time.
But I would pick you up. I'm going to pick you up on the, well, not pick you up, but I'm going to zero in on something you talked about, and that's the Poland game, right? Mm. The Poland game for me was dangerously close to not turning the possession into enough chances.
Absolutely.
And then getting undone by a mistake, which we've seen with John Stones. And that, you know, if we're going to talk about the hallmark of Gareth Southgate's career, the hallmark of this show is John Stones making bastard mistakes for England. And it seems to happen so often that we have to talk about it. He made a mistake in that. I don't know what he was playing at. For those who don't remember it, he mucked about with the ball, got caught.
I mean, it's a really bad mistake.
Really, but it wasn't even just a kind of misplaced pass. Yeah. It was indecision, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you can't, you can't get into the habit of having loads of possession, being really comfortable on the ball, and pat yourself on the back on how technically great your creative midfield players are, not create proper chances, not take the chances you've not created, and then make mistakes at the back.
Yeah.
And that was probably the takeaway from the Poland game, but I don't really know, and maybe you do, but I don't really know what Southgate does about that, because ultimately you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink, right?
Totally, yeah. I think with John Stones, he is a starter. He's probably... he might be England's best centre half that's fit, and he's a decent player, but he has these ricks, and how you get him out of that is very, very difficult. I mean, in the Poland game itself, you know, Sterling looked good early on. He won a penalty, and again, you thought to yourself, well, Sterling's a starter now for England. Well, going into the tournament, is he a starter?
And that's why this is fascinating, and that's why it's refreshing, because we didn't used to have this situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, Raheem Sterling himself
yeah.
has been a beneficiary of a previous era where he kept mm-hmm. getting picked.
Yeah.
His goal scoring record for England particularly was really, really poor until quite recently.
Well, it was a game against Spain that we talked about a few weeks ago, that when he broke his duck, you know, which was a long time not scoring.
But I don't know if this will happen. I mean, this is not a prediction of mine, but under Southgate, you wouldn't be surprised if Sterling wasn't picked for the first game in the Euros.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's a good thing. That's something you should be making a kind of virtue of, because it means that he feels there's another player in there that's in better form despite Sterling's reputation, mm-hmm. and he's happy to pick him. So there are reasons to be positive as well.
Yeah. And in that Poland game, England went 1-0 up and looked comfortable. They were keeping possession. I can't remember Poland creating much at all. And I know they were out without one or two of their best players. But like, England, they had possession, and you thought to yourself, oh, right, are England actually just going to take it easy? They're going to keep the ball, Poland won't be able to score, and England will go on and get the second, and this will be quite comfortable. Well, they didn't produce many other chances after that, which is a problem. When you're playing against a side which is inferior to you, you have the ball, and you've got an hour left to play, or whatever it was, you need that second goal, really. You need to sort of create a bit. Then, of course, as you say, the mistake came. And I couldn't believe, after that mistake, how quickly it felt like, oh, same old England.
Yeah.
How the shoulders dropped a bit. England didn't really create much after that, other than the Maguire goal, which was knocked down from a corner. Okay, they showed character. They won the game. So you have to give a bit of credit there. They won the match.
Yeah.
And I know sometimes we want a beautiful Spain 2012 carved move open. And well, that's the only type of goals we want to score. Otherwise, it doesn't really count.
But England are capable of that now. We saw that in the Austria game.
We saw
they can strike.
One.
They can strike really quick now.
Yeah, but I found it interesting. With Jonathan Liu wrote a piece in the Guardian this week. And it was all about England's poor track record of not winning matches in which they take the lead.
Mm-hmm.
And he was absolutely right. England have taken, this is Jonathan writing, England have taken the lead in each of their past five tournament knockout games and only won once.
Mm-hmm.
That was against Sweden in 2018. Now, of course, you know, against Colombia, they won on penalties, you know. So I know you could say, well, they took the lead and they
Well, they can see their equaliser very late on and then won on penalties.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that for some kind of quirk of stats, that won't go down as a win, but it is a win.
Mm.
So we have to bear that in mind.
Mm. England have only won 13 out of 26 games when scoring first at a tournament.
And the reason I think that's interesting is because, set in context, the statistics show, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I'm fairly certain the statistics show that in football generally, if you go ahead, your chances of winning are very, very high.
Well, I have the statistics, which is in Jonathan's piece. The Netherlands, when they've gone ahead, 89.5% win percentage. So they go ahead, they're on for it.
Yeah.
France, 88%. Belgium, 86. Germany, 86. Spain, 81. Portugal, 80. Italy, 72. England, 50%.
I'm afraid to go there now.
Yeah.
I'm afraid for us to be in the tournament.
We should play for penalties.
I think the reason why this happens, and again, you're the stats man here today, clearly I'm not. I'm admittedly basing this on, I think, on the Iceland game in 2016. But I wouldn't
another
be,
one.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be surprised, Marcus, if that what happens is that England concede, generally speaking, quite quickly after they score. Right? If that's the case, to me, it feels like, particularly in the Iceland game, when that did happen, England relax after they score, because they're under so much pressure.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that at all levels of football. Once you score a goal, that's when you're vulnerable. And in England, I think that's just dialed up to 100 because the pressure is so high.
Mm.
They score, they relax, they don't even know they're doing it. And even if they don't concede quickly, of course, sometimes they do, but even if they don't concede quickly, I wouldn't be surprised if they concede control of the game and cede control of the game quickly. And that makes it harder for them because of the pressure they feel like they're under.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that French players aren't under pressure or Netherlands players aren't under pressure. Of course, there's a pressure environment. But I think with England, it is particularly bad because of the barren run they've had. So that might explain it. But you're right to say England have got to sort that out. And to relate that to the Poland game, Poland had one shot on target in that game, and that was the goal that we made a mistake on.
Yeah.
And playing against Poland, who haven't got Lewandowski in their team, is a very different proposition because he's the world's best number nine.
Mm.
So that plays into it as well. You're right to say that England need to put these teams to bed. When you look at it, it's a win, but it's also a penalty from Harry Kane, a nod down from a corner, which Maguire rifles into the roof of the net, and we make it difficult for ourselves by making a completely unforced error. That's the fact of the matter, and that's the most recent competitive game England have played, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we've got to bear that in mind.
I should say the stat is that since the start of the century, England have only won 13 out of 26 games when scoring first at a tournament.
Well, this century or the last one?
Does it matter? Does it matter? Yeah. So going into the tournament, I think that some people are a bit starry-eyed at some of the forward players we have and the full-back options and so on. But my concern is that England have these deep problems with their footballing culture at international level about lacking a bit of street wisdom, you know, not being able to hold on to a lead, how to turn that possession into goals, how to, you know, to soak up on the counter and then hit them, which England could do. They have pacey players, they have creative players. We saw that, you know, that's why that game away in Spain that I keep going on about. Yeah. Sorry about that.
They did that against Albania.
Yeah.
The other day. Not Albania, Austria, sorry. The other day.
Yeah.
That's how they scored.
Yeah. And so England...
They're capable
of doing it. But it is a case of, right, how are you going to do that? Because if England are playing against superior teams, which if England get through the group, which they should, if they do, and I don't want to tempt fate, they will almost certainly play a top side in the next round. How do England then, you know, if you go ahead, or even if you don't go ahead, you're under pressure. As you say, they're playing Portugal. And you've got, look at that front line they've got. Mm. How are you going to soak that up and then hit them on the break? Mm. How are you going to do, and that's something that Southgate has to get right. And I think that I understand the 4-3-3, and that is my preference. I also understand a back three, maybe 3-4-3, maybe a 3-5-2. But those big question marks still remain for me.
Yes, the big unanswered questions that Southgate needs to answer, or the England squad need to answer for this tournament, for me, are you've got to sort out what you're going to play a back four or a back three, given the personnel you have available to you. I understand he may not have that information at this point, but at some point it needs to be answered, otherwise the tournament's going to pass them by.
Yeah.
They need to work out how they take control of games and keep it. And I actually think that you might find that... someone like Jack Grealish is key to that because he can carry the ball, because he can win fouls so much, because he can frustrate.
Takes a lot of pressure off the defence.
Exactly. Massively. Yeah. And you've also got other players like Mount and Foden who can also do that. Mm-hmm. I think we haven't talked enough about Mason Mount's passing. I think his passing is unbelievably good. We've seen it in, not just in the Champions League final, but we've seen it for England. Mm-hmm. And that's really important to take control of the game as well. But they also need to make sure that they can perform under pressure, can settle on the formation they want to play in, can understand who replaces who in the case of injury, and make that more coherent. And of course, half these questions I'm putting here, they may have already answered. They're just saying, I'm not going to fucking tell you about it. Yeah, and why would they? You know, fine, I hope that is the case. But if it isn't, that's what needs to be answered, in my opinion. I don't know if you'd add anything to that, Marcus.
Yeah, I agree. I just wonder, you know, as I say, I think 4-3-3 I would want for the opening game, go a bit more on the front foot. They're at Wembley as well, which does help. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah, and ultimately, Marcus, that's a really important point. Sorry to cut in, but I do think that 4-3-3 is the best formation. Can England beat Croatia at home in a tournament with a back four that is Stones and one other?
Cody, probably. Let's say Cody, for example.
I think you'd say that you probably can. Mm. And if it's too much of a sacrifice to change it so much for the reasons you said earlier in the show, maybe you do go with a back four. Maybe you're brave about it.
Maybe.
Be brave.
Be bloody brave.
Yeah.
And be good as well. And streetwise, please.
And whatever happens, we'll be cheering you on.
Absolutely right.
But we may call for Southgate's head later in the summer. On a day that Marcus is in the studio. No, it's been great anyway. It's been great doing this series. I've really enjoyed it.
I have indeed. Thank you very much for listening to Lions Watch. And thank you for joining us throughout this series. It's come to an end, but not really, because it's come to an end on Football Ramble Presents.
Yeah.
But then it goes over because we're going mainstream, baby.
Yeah.
And we're on Football Ramble, of course, because we're covering all the moments throughout Euro 2020. So head over to that feed and subscribe wherever you get your pods to make sure you never miss an episode. Oh, it's reaching fever pitch. And I'm not just saying that because Nick Hornby was in the studio recently. Marvellous stuff. Well, look, if you've got Harry Kane up front and you've got Jack Grealish and Phil Foden, there's still a chance, everybody.
There's always a chance. Well, there's hope.
That's right.
Well, there's Grealish, there's hope.
Absolutely right. There we are. Enjoy it. We'll see you on the Football Ramble feed. And thank you very much, Luke.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. See you soon.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hold up.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, mate.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking out?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.